The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google. What makes them industry giants? Get ready to take a peek inside and learn their secrets of success. This is Silicon Valley Insider, the show that demystifies the Valley and helps to elevate your business to the next level. Now, your host for Silicon Valley Insider, Keith Koo.
Welcome to Silicon Valley Insider. I'm your host, Keith Koo, and today I'm very excited to announce that I have as my special guest Ellen Petrie Lyons, who is the author of The Happiness Hack. And Ellen has been on Megyn Kelly. She's been on CNN. She's a frequent podcaster, mentor, and coach. But I think what most people probably don't realize is she's had a 35-year Silicon Valley career. So Ellen, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Keith.
And for today's show, we'll be diving into Ellen's history, what drives her, what her passions, and really happy to have you here. And before we do that, we're going to get into tech news. As always, this has been a very interesting tech news week. First off, Cambridge Analytica just announced that they are folding shop. So Cambridge and their parent company, SCL Group, said that due to all the negative publicity and not admitting any guilt, they have gone bankrupt. They said that the amount of publicity that they got made it so that they no longer had customers and therefore they weren't viable. And so they just folded up shop and they're gone. On other interesting news, the city of Atlanta last month was hit with a pretty significant ransomware attack known as SamSam. And the fallout from that was that they paid, in essence, $2.6 million to remediate. So that's all the consultants, the technology companies on how to get their data back, which I don't think they did, or they could have paid a ransom of about $50,000. Now, I'm not advocating paying a ransom, but I will tell you that it's interesting that now SamSam, the group behind the attack, is offering a volume discount. So the funny thing about this is that they're now saying that they can basically pay one Bitcoin for a single user or five Bitcoin for an unlimited number of users. And at today's valuation, give or take, that's about $8,000 to $50,000. So just think about that again. And there was a study also done by Telstra that said that in Asia-Pac, for instance, 57% of all companies impacted by ransomware do in fact pay a ransom. So again, not advice either way. Just think about your options very carefully. Facebook came out with some announcements this week about new features, and the most interesting feature that they're coming out with is that you will now have the ability to clear your browsing history, which you never had before. So very similar to other browsers like Google, you can then now control what data has been collected on you and selectively delete that history. And the other thing that Facebook announced is they're going to compete directly with eHarmony and Match.com by becoming a dating site. Final news item is that Google is going to push all the potential liability of GDPR regulations, the data privacy rules that go into effect on May 25th, onto the publishers. And I'll talk more about that next week. Ellen, thanks again for being here. So when we say 35 years as a veteran, that's kind of an understatement. I mean, you've done Apple, Google, Facebook. You've contracted for many other companies, including my old home, Cisco. What was it like to be really at the birth of what we know as Silicon Valley today? What was it like to be at Apple in the 80s?
Well, first of all, anything I could say about Apple would be amazing. It was a fantastic experience. And I feel so lucky that many people from that world are still part of my world today. But I'd actually love to wind back even a little bit earlier than 1981 when I joined Apple and really talk about a child, being a child growing up in this area, watching the rise of the valley. You know, I grew up surrounded by cherry trees and apricot trees when Silicon Valley was still kind of the home of fruit trees and agriculture. And I think they called it the Valley of Earthly Delights. But around the time I was 6 or 7 years old, I started to notice some changes. And I started to notice people coming here from different parts of the world, and that my parents would talk about them as being scientists or people with, you know, computer technology degrees or computer science degrees. And my father, who was an engineer himself, though more with mechanical engineering, talking about the rise of even people he knew who were joining these technology companies. So as a young person growing up in the Valley, I saw these changes coming as more and more people started talking about and working on this thing called tech. And as I watched that happen, it would have been hard to miss also the economic changes that came along with it. And some of those economic changes meant that some of those orchards that I used to run around and play in became parks with, you know, large office buildings in them and so forth. And I remember seeing Cupertino changing because I grew up in San Jose and, you know, we'd drive up to Palo Alto or to San Francisco, which was a big trip back in the day.
Right.
Who would have thought I'd be making that trip every day, you know, for some chapters of my life. But it was a big deal then. But you would notice, you know, change over change as you drove by. But at early Apple, what it felt like was a bunch of people coming together, guided by a certain vision or light, you know, sort of a direction we're all going in. And few of us really knew how we were going to get there. We didn't have the maps because so often these things had never been done before. So a gift that early Apple gave to me was really the gift of sort of making the next best move you can make at any time, even if you don't exactly know where it's going to lead, and then trusting the people that you work and collaborate with to help you think through those decisions. So you've debugged to some extent whatever that next move might be.
That's fascinating. Thanks for sharing that story. I can think about myself growing up in the Bay Area and how that transformation was happening. I used to drive down and visit my uncles living, working for these tech companies as well, and just how the orchards were disappearing and how these things were happening. And I want to tie it back to, you just said with the Apple, one of the learnings you had was really how you all were growing up with this change and how you were being your best next self. How would that compare to what's happening in Silicon Valley today? Do you see much of a change or a difference, or you see it's very similar?
I do see a difference, Keith. It's a really interesting question. So back there, you know, I said we didn't really have any maps. We had to sort of rely on the compass. And bringing people together to talk about how we might solve a problem and what would happen if we did this or that. You know, we were stepping forth knowing that there was some uncharted terrain there. And today, although we are still innovating, there are a lot more maps to follow. And I think that is probably the biggest change that I see relative to that time is that even in when Apple was innovating and entrepreneuring, we weren't like some of the other companies, the even then legacy companies that had been established here. We were really different. And when I look at the Valley now and at the tech industry now, I see more people following maps than really following the compass. I think that the bold light that drove Apple at that time, certainly we were, you know, even by the time I joined, we were a publicly traded company, but we were definitely a business that was looking to sell computers, but we were in it for more than simply to create wealth or value. We're really in it to change the world. You know, Steve would say things like, this is my paraphrasing, it's not his direct quote, but the product is not the product. The product is the delivery vehicle for a change in a person's life that is valuable to them and helps them be a better version of themselves. Design that change and people will buy your product. Well, I think now people are talking more about get them to buy the product.
Yeah.
So there is a big difference. I notice us maybe not being as bold as we were at that time and maybe not having a vision that is really as much about the aspirations of people than we had at that time.
Well, thanks, Ellen. I mean, I think this is a really good history, and I think it's a really good way to talk about in our next segment because there's just so much of your own personal experience that you've put into your next phase of your career and in your book. So before we get to our next segment, I wanted to do a couple of reminders, very timely. The 2018 San Jose Smart City Conference is on May 11th. It's free at San Jose City Hall. And it's almost like what you just said, Ellen, this compass that now we have to actually talk about technologies to make our cities better. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's just a really interesting comment you were making about the rise of Silicon Valley and kind of what's happened through that. So again, if you have questions or comments or you want to talk about something on the show, email us at info@svin.biz. You're listening to Silicon Valley Insider with Keith Koo, and we'll be right back.
For questions or comments on today's program, call 1-888-828-7846. That's 888-828-SVIN. Now, back to Silicon Valley Insider. Once again, your host, Keith Koo.
Hello, Insiders. Welcome back to the show, Silicon Valley Insider with Keith Koo. Today, I'm joined by author Ellen Petrie Lyons, author of The Happiness Hack. Thanks again for being here.
It's great to be here.
So the email question of the week is, Keith, in past shows, you've talked about an instant messenger application called Telegram, and we hear that Telegram is worth a couple billion dollars. What exactly is Telegram? So the answer to that is we know about instant messengers in the past, from AOL to Yahoo to now iMessage on the phone, and in Chinese circles, WeChat, Korean circles, Kakao, all these different instant messenger apps. Why do we need another one? Well, Telegram was started by Russians as a secure messaging platform. And the key thing is that it is the instant messenger application of choice for blockchain startups, or actually all blockchain companies. In fact, if you're a blockchain company, you don't have a Telegram app, you're probably a fake company. So what makes Telegram special? It works for individuals, it works for businesses. It supports text, video, and audio messages. It works with almost every operating system. I think what most people are really driven to, it's highly secure. When I mean secure, that there are options to encrypt messages, encrypt files. Think of the anti-Snapchat. Even though Snapchat says they're secure, that stuff is being stored somewhere. Telegram is also being famous. It's raised $2 billion and growing. And so this is just something that will continue to be in the news. And that's what Telegram is. So Ellen, thanks again for being here.
Thank you, Keith.
In our first segment, we got into a really good history of you and I both growing up in the Bay Area, you specifically growing up in the Silicon Valley, watching orchards change, your time at Apple, and what a special time that was. We also tied in that, what is Silicon Valley of today? And I think that's really interesting, right? Because your book, The Happiness Hack, and you were featured on Megyn Kelly specifically for your book, it's really driving home that in this whole Silicon Valley craze, people aren't often happy. Mm-hmm. People are trying to either achieve a dream, trying to either raise capital, be the next Steve Jobs. But sometimes it doesn't seem that they're actually very happy. What do you make of that?
One thing that hit me with the way you voiced the question, Keith, is that you talked about things that people were doing that was chasing other people's maps. And I do think that there's a correlation between our own personal happiness and satisfaction and how autonomous we are, how much we feel that there is something we have to do in order to be, or in order to be a good person, or in order to be happy. You know, there's a quote in my book that says, happiness is not a destination, but a way of traveling. And I've really come to believe that you can really move to almost any direction or destination you believe in. If you have the right mindsets and the right practices, you can do it with a high degree of satisfaction. But I think what the question also looks into is something that caused this book to actually come to be. And that is, as a person who worked in tech for 35 years and who spent a lot of time working with products that promise to deliver solutions to problems, you know, and the problems I'm thinking about is, gosh, there's never enough time to do all the things we want to do. Or what if it was easier or less repetitive to do this? All these products started to rise that solve these problems for us. And yet I began to notice that although these problems were being solved, other problems were coming up and people were not really appreciating the improvement to their life or the improvement to their happiness that those products should, and I'm making, you know, air quotations, should have delivered. And as a person who's always been very interested in the way the brain works, has been sort of, you know, following neuroscience and learning from neuroscience research over the years, that I worked in the Valley and even, you know, very much so in recent years, I started understanding some things about the way the brain worked that maybe suited us way, way, way back when in the earlier human times, but that maybe weren't as well suited to bringing us happiness or satisfaction at this time. One thing I really want to say quickly is there are different forms of happiness that the brain and thus the person experiences. There is the very immediate sort of motivation and reward-based happiness that really served us well, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago or tens of thousands of years ago when we had to make snap decisions fast and sort of grab that juicy grub that we saw on the tree or turn and run as fast as we could from something that frightened us or notice a shiny rock on the ground that we could make into an arrowhead or whatever we were doing as people at that time. Those loops of motivation and reward were giving us one very specific type of brain chemical response that created feelings of happiness. But the other type was more of the long, slow build that we got by being connected to other people, having a sense of belonging, by making contributions to whatever our clans needed to survive better, you know, like long, slow work that might have been hard, but that made a difference. And then also growth, getting better at something or living in alignment with some sort of purpose or some sort of belief system or faith. And I noticed that with the rise of these things that gave us that quick gratification reward, I sensed a decline in relationships, a real feeling of contribution, you know, as we sort of moved from doing important work to doing busy work because everyone feels so busy. And then also in growth, where is this all really heading? And what is my own personal or spiritual growth at this time? And it was in that contrast between those sort of fast and juicy, what, you know, on the Megyn Kelly show, they called the tequila shot happiness. It's sort of what I call it. The tequila shot happiness of instant gratification, largely rewarded by the, you know, apps and tech experiences we have right now, but away from the things that were more that deeper, real human satisfaction.
Now, that's really great comment. I was thinking about going through lots of leadership training and how we often talk about Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
And we
talk about how for a human existence, however long you believe that is, right, is that we were chasing survival. And I tell my kids this, even until the 1850s, until the Industrial Revolution, it really was for thousands or millions or billions, you know, depending on your belief system, humans pretty much acted the same way. We're chasing sustenance. And then the rise of industry allowed us to do more things. That's what Maslow's hierarchy of needs states, is that we keep moving up the pyramid until we get to self-actualization, self-attainment. But now I'm thinking, you know, as you and I get to know each other better, I'm thinking more about, you made a really great comment on either your TED Talk or Megyn Kelly, but it was about we in Silicon Valley expect that we're going to have breakthrough innovation to really fix all these things that we as humans can't fix on our own. But if we just took the devices out, or if we just controlled our devices or the need to invent or create technology, we might be able to get to a state of happiness without all that.
There's so much to unpack there. But as a matter of fact, I think one of the things technology is doing, and this sort of always on technology is doing, is actually giving us an opportunity to say, when we are not moving toward our real purpose and our real self-actualization, other things will come in and kind of take over our life path and actually prevent us from moving up through that hierarchy. So I actually have been drawing the hierarchy these days and sort of ways of navigating it in the time of tech. But very basically, food, clothing, and shelter, the very basic needs at the bottom, those are sort of taken care of. The next step above that is belonging. And one of the things there's belonging, there's safety. I think safety comes after food, clothing, and shelter. That was good. Yeah. Then safety, then belonging, and then you move up toward the self-actualization. One of the things is that with all the bombardment of tech and all the demands on our time, I don't think people really feel that safe right now. I think most people that I interact with feel like they're always sort of tipped back in a way that there's something more that they should or could be doing that they're grasping for, but they don't really know how to do it. And in that confused state that the brain enters into when we don't have that safety, we don't always make the best decisions. And one of the decisions I think we're not making all that well right now is how we actually use our time.
I see that, Ellen, and thank you. And I'm going to pause you right there because a lot of great stuff to talk about. So you're listening to Keith Koo on Silicon Valley Insider. I'm joined by author Ellen Petrie-Lyons of The Happiness Hack. For any questions, you can email us at info@svn.biz. And we'll be right back.
For questions or comments on today's program, call 1-888-828-7846. That's 888-828-SVIN. Now, back to Silicon Valley Insider. Once again, your host, Keith Koo.
Welcome to Silicon Valley Insider. I'm your host, Keith Koo. And today I'm joined with author Ellen Petrie-Lyons of The Happiness Hack. This week's cyber tip is still the ongoing saga of social media. And really the story here is, even with all the news that we've heard on Facebook, Cambridge Analytica, and all the other social media platforms, it actually becomes a new vector for social engineering and social media. And that's really where I think people don't still quite understand that you're the product in these social media platforms and that you need to be able to actively control your digital life. And so the tip here is twofold. One is social engineering, or when people are sending you emails, phishing, which we've talked about before, but how that combined with a social media hack, which is where they're scraping your information, you've left your information exposed, can be really, really detrimental, especially in actual physical attacks like the theft or burglary of your home. So here are some tips. Always check your privacy settings. So when you're posting something on Facebook or LinkedIn or Twitter or Instagram, know which audience you're actually trying to reach. Are you really trying to post to the entire world, or are you just trying to post to a select group of friends or family? In fact, you can do things even further by compartmentalizing or segmenting into groups so that you can actually just make a very small set of those people that are you connected with. Additionally, if you have the discipline, limit your connections. You don't have to accept every invite. And in fact, if you accept every invite, sometimes those are the ones that have the packed malicious attacks. So just be careful. Just because some really good-looking Eastern European model wants to be your best friend, you should think twice about that. And lastly, you should also think twice about posting content as well. We've said it before, just because you're in Aruba, maybe you should be posting live that you're in Aruba and your house is empty. And that's the tip of the week. So welcome back. Ellen, thanks again for being here.
It's great to be here.
So one thing I think we should talk about is your book, The Happiness Hack. Why now?
You know, it's funny, Keith, as I was listening to you talk about social media and social networks and the way that we're interacting with it, I think that's why now. One of the things that I looked at as I was learning about the brain and understanding the brain's motivation and response cycles and watching, because I was working in Silicon Valley in the industry and during the rise of applications after, you know, smartphones became, showed up in everyone's pocket, I really saw how designers were using the motivation and reward cycles of the brain to optimize their products and to drive very specific behaviors from it. And that is really the true why now of my book. So there's something everyone should know about the brain, and that is your brain will do more of whatever it's doing right now. Another way that people say it is, as your brain fires, it wires. And because of that, the behaviors that we have actually do change our brains. They change them both in terms of the brain chemicals that are produced in the brain as a result of certain processes or experiences, thoughts and behavior, but also over time in the patterns that your brain actually, the pathways that it forms and the way that your brain really updates the routines that it runs. And I watched how social media was so tapping into, almost hijacking those brain cycles that people had at a level that I had never seen before, even imagined before. So I like to say that it's as if the designers of some of these products, either intentionally or unintentionally, showed up with a black belt in how to hijack your brain chemistry. And we didn't even know we were in the dojo.
No, that I mean, I love you that you bring this up, because even as late as last week, one of the very senior folks at Facebook, a VP, I won't name that person, but they had said that they actually felt a lot of regret. Mm-hmm. And actually, Sean Parker himself had said it. This is quoted, that if he had known what he was launching when he was investing in what we have as Facebook as of today, he might have thought twice, because it really is this ability now to affect brain patterns, affect people's abilities to make informed decisions?
100%. At global scale.
Yeah.
And the reach of this is really something that we have never experienced. I mean, I would love if people saw differently, but I can't think of any example in history, and so far no one has ever told me, of a change that is affecting the people of the planet at the scale and at the velocity that the spread of technologies, especially, you know, digital technologies delivered over mobile devices is. And, you know, you said something a few moments ago that I think is important for everyone to heed, and that is you are the product. What these products are doing is looking to offer an experience, a tempting, tantalizing, or, you know, motivating experience in exchange for something, your time, your attention, your money, your use of their product over a different product. And what I feel has happened, these things have hit us so fast we weren't really prepared for them. And, you know, some people say, well, even on the interview with Megyn Kelly, she said, do you have a smartphone? I was like, heck yes. You know, I couldn't live without it. And I have learned through some hard knocks and through experience and also through really almost the astonishment of looking at what these are doing to our brains. I've learned to be in charge of it rather than in charge of me. And I also have experienced how easily that in charge of me could take over. It takes a lot of intention and a lot of understanding what the value of hacking back is in order to make the effort and form the patterns that let you hack back. And Keith, because I have this optimism, I can't help myself. I really believe that these are teaching us, or they're asking us a tough question right now. What do we want and what are we willing to do to get it? Do we want to simply be distracted by and entertained by tech that promises it's going to, you know, give us a thumbs up or a like, even though we're giving it our precious time in exchange for that? Or do we want to say, no, what I want here really matters and who I am matters. And I am going to use my higher human powers to resist these easy distractions, these tequila shots of happiness, and learn to do more of what I really want in life so that I can make similar evaluations as the next new wave of shiny object comes and, you know, hits me. Because trust me, it will come.
Well, that's where I think your book and writing it has become such a valuable pause, right? I was saying that even for the show, we've featured a lot of innovation over the last year. We've talked about fintech and blockchain ad nauseum. We've talked about cyber risk and security. We've talked about hacking and data breaches. We talked about artificial intelligence. The show we had last week was with a startup called Dotten. They're the first artificial intelligence platform meets Myers-Briggs that's been approved for use in the UK and the state of California. And then they really tried to say that they have artificial intelligence and the ethics behind that. Mm-hmm. But I think that's where I think people have been on autopilot. I think the rise of tech, especially certainly the last 30 years, not the last 10, smart devices, people have kind of ridden that wave. And I like that, again, back to this theme of pausing, you have total control over your life, right? I think it's going to be more interesting to talk about how this people react to your book cross-culturally around the world. Because one of the things about artificial intelligence, this is where people think that they're losing control. You hear about artificial intelligence taking over jobs. You know, we knew about this in terms of music. I'll use this story. A few years ago, there was a Beyonce song that came out that was very popular. And there was a Kelly Clarkson song that came out that was very popular. And it turns out, if you Google the story, they both actually bought the same music, even though they had different lyrics and a totally different track, right? And how that happens is there's this Scandinavian music company that sells music, and it's been finely tuned to your brain.
Oh, right.
So they know that music will very responsive.
You. Yeah.
And they happen to sell the – which is very common. They happen to sell the music at the same time. And both artists picked it up, and they both released songs at the same time. Mm-hmm. And Beyonce's song came out before Kelly's song came out, and everybody thought that Kelly had stolen the song. Mm. And you can Google it, there's mashups and all that. But I'm going to bring that back to people are on autopilot. Mm-hmm. And that's the takeaway I get from your book is that people are on autopilot. They're living this life, going through the motions, especially even in the Silicon Valley where you might be making a lot of money, but you're just not truly satisfied or happy. And that's where I think what you've written and where this is going to go internationally would be very interesting.
I hope that's true. And the thing is that we do carry around, you know, in our heads a piece of ancient history. And it is a decision-making apparatus or technology. It's probably more than that, but a big part of what it does is it makes decisions to keep you safe and alive based on what was happening back, you know, tens, if not hundreds, well, really hundreds of thousands of years ago, and then for even longer if you look at the entire sort of mammalian chain that led up to it. And the thing is that that left to itself, there are brain sets that are the way this thing runs. But the beautiful thing in our brain sets is that they are coachable. They are trainable. The brain is plastic. And we aren't really taught how to work with our brain to get more of what we want out of our lives. And I hope that's what my book is inviting, is people to reflect and consider that. You know, I love talking, people talk about mindsets, like growth mindsets and how to practice the growth mindset. I love to talk about a continuum, and that's being aware of the brain sets, which is sort of the biological way the brain will run, the mindsets that guide us intentionally to be more of what we want to be and get more of what we want out of life, and then the skill sets that we practice. And those can be even tiny little things that we do that help guide the mindsets that actually with time allow the brain to update. Not all, because the brain has a lot of really deeply set brain sets, but at least some of the brain sets that shape our life day to day. We have much more control over that than I think we've been told. And tech is giving us the ubiquity of tech is giving us an opportunity to do kind of exactly what you suggested with the music, to decide what we want and what we're willing to do to get it, to be more intentional with what we get out of our life and the various technologies that support it.
That's powerful. Within a minute, what would you think would be the hope for people listening?
Well, first of all, I think to really feel inside themselves, if they're resonating with what I'm saying, they probably sort of knew something like this all along. But you then can use that to say, then you can see how powerful this change that is being brought on by tech would be. And then come in and say, wow, you know, maybe I'm really connecting with something that's more me inside than what everything outside is telling me I should be. And start doing 5% more of that, whatever that is a day. And especially if it has to do with connecting with people you care about and love in your life, because they're probably being hacked by the same phenomena.
I love that comment. Definitely should take that to heart. So you're listening again to Silicon Valley Insider with Keith Koo. I'm joined today by author Ellen Petrie Lyons of The Happiness Hack. You can find Ellen's book, The Happiness Hack, on Amazon.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back on Silicon Valley Insider and wrap up with Ellen.
For questions or comments on today's program, call 1-888-828-7846. That's 888-828-SVIN. Now, back to Silicon Valley Insider. Once again, your host, Keith Koo.
Hi, Insiders. Welcome back to the show, Silicon Valley Insider with Keith Koo. Today, I'm joined with author Ellen Petrie Lyons, author of The Happiness Hack. And one thing I wanted to mention is Ellen teaches exactly what we've been talking about on the show today. She teaches a course at Stanford. The topic is on neuroscience, creativity, and innovation. And it's a good way of understanding the brain and how that leads to exceptional product experience. So if you're interested more about that, email us at info@svin.biz and we'll get you connected. So Ellen, thanks again for being here.
It's great to be here. I hope to come back and talk about the neuroscience of innovation sometime in the future.
You'll definitely be back. It's been a phenomenal discussion we've had and very relevant, not just because we're in Silicon Valley, but to all the listeners of this podcast and the show throughout, because the concepts you've been bringing up, I think, are very, very personal for people because everyone's chasing the dream. And sometimes they're on autopilot, sometimes they're intentional. But I think it's really important for people to understand and be self-aware so that they're not just driven an unknown feeling. Like back to what we said in an earlier segment about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's almost like the digital version of that.
Mm-hmm.
So what have been some of the outcomes from your book?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's been so wonderful to go from place to place and, you know, visit independent bookstores and talk with people who've read the book and also to receive feedback from people who have read it. The main thing that I think is landing for people is they are realizing they are more than their brains. A message that the book delivers is that the brain's job isn't necessarily to think. It's really to think in service of keeping us safe and alive. And if we think of what's kept us safe and alive, the brain is always going to have a map of the past. It's always going to be calling on the things that have gotten you from wherever, way back when, whether you're aware of it or not. It could be conscious or subconscious, but up until this moment. So especially for people, you have an audience of innovators, the brain is always going to be a little bit resistant to the new. It's going to find ways to keep us in old patterns rather than really open us up into new. And the thing that I teach in the class of on the neuroscience of creativity and innovation is that even on a functional level, on a biological level, the brain moves from a very wide way of seeing things that's sort of our curiosity and our sense of wonder that we have in childhood to a much more sort of focused and directed laser beam way of seeing things once the brain fully matures. So a thing that people get from the book are ways of sort of challenging those brain sets of the adult brain to think different, my very favorite expression, and to get out of the familiar ways of thinking and into more sense of curiosity. This pays off in a lot of ways that bring me a lot of satisfaction. First, people will talk about feeling more mindful. They are more aware of what's going on after they've read the book. There's a really wonderful book called Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman.
Right.
But they say that they learn ways to shift from their fast brain, something that we talk about a lot in the book, and much more into their more responsive and slightly slower. We're talking very slightly slower. Brains, the parts of the brains that process higher human cognition, more things about long-term planning and troubleshooting and thinking about unintended consequences and all of these things that really are the highest human capacity of our brain. People talk about changing habits, which is really satisfying. I touch on that in a short section in the book on how to speed the adoption of new healthy habits. But my favorite story happened in a tiny little bookstore in Iowa, where I met a gentleman who had read the book, and he was a person who came in and bought one book a month from this bookstore. And according to what the bookstore owner told me, he often paid with change. And I was so surprised when I met him, and he told me he read his book. He had read my book, and he said, "Since I've read your book, I've almost stopped smoking. I realized reading your book that my brain wanted a cigarette, but I didn't want it. And I started being able to tell my brain, no, that's you telling me, and I'm in charge of you." And then he said, little by little, I was able to cut back into the point where I'm almost done smoking. So what, you know, that might be a one-off, but that sure was a satisfying experience. What I would want to take away from that is that people are realizing that they're not only run by their brain, and they can get back in charge of what they really want from their life in ways that are healthier and more sustainable and much happier as they move to the future.
That's a really powerful story as well. I mean, I think even if it's a one-off, your book affected an individual and they were able to make a behavioral change, right?
Yeah.
So I think that also goes back into the nurture versus nature conversation or and how you had made a good comment off during the break about how nurture and nature, there's a relationship between the two of them.
They are inextricably linked. You know, people often ask me that question, are we nurture or nature? And if you look at the nature, what it is doing is setting up a perfect scenario for recording the nurture from the environment around it. So there's this beautiful, you know, with my hands right now, I'm sort of doing this thing where I'm linking my hands together. They really connect to each other. It's the way the brain works to record our environment and our experience of the environment is absolutely about it figuring out what it takes for us to be safe and alive. And those things fit together like key and lock. But understanding that both of them have roles is really important to getting more of what we want out of the way our brains work.
Well, Ellen, with that, we're out of time, unfortunately, but it's been really great having you here today. We've learned so much about your history. We actually didn't talk about your handmade necklace by Thomas Mann, but we'll do that for another show when you're back.
Oh, I'd love that.
And so, once again, we've been joined today by Ellen Petrie-Lyons, the author of The Happiness Hack. Her book is available on Amazon.com. She and I, as of this air date, will be both at the Thai Inflect Conference in Silicon Valley. And if you have any questions or comments, please email us at info@svnup.biz. You can reach me on LinkedIn, Keith Koo, or Facebook, Keith Koo. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back next week.
You've been listening to Silicon Valley Insider with Keith Koo. For questions or comments on today's program, or to schedule a complimentary consultation with Keith about your business, call 1-888-828-SVIN. That's 1-888-828-7846. 888-828-SVIN.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.